The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thank you, George. This is the last of the talks on Exodus, and just to repeat, each week we've really just been dipping into what's a wonderful book, so I do see these more as teasers to have you go away and read it for see the story of freedom and how it is that God saved these people from slavery in Egypt to be free to worship him. And yet today we come to this darkest kind of moment that we're supposed to look back on and see the world differently because of. Yesterday was the 18th anniversary of 9/11. I can't believe it's 18 years. When it happened, I heard it on the radio just as I was going to bed that a plane had hit the first tower. And I got up and I turned the TV on because it sounded bad. And my wife was nursing our newborn, who's about to finish the HSC. And we saw the second plane hit. And then we saw the news of the Pentagon and a plane coming down in Pennsylvania. And you just didn't know when it was going to stop. And then we had those looped images of the planes hitting the towers. And for months afterwards, it seemed that that footage kept being shown. And to this day, I just can't watch that. I've never watched the bodies falling. I know that footage exists, but I just shut my eyes and turned from it. And it came into my... it is that haunting kind of thing when you see evil step into the world. We'd lived in London before in times of bombing, and our church had been hit by the IRA, but so it wasn't as though we hadn't seen terrible things before, but there was something different about the scale of this, I think, the ruthless planning that had gone into it, that said we knew that partly because it hit America on its own soil, that the response would be probably like what we saw played out, that it was going to make the world different. And that has been the world our kids have grown up in. They're used to having to think differently about planes and travel and the world. And it reset your expectations of how it is that we live together in this world. I think too easily we slip into normalising something even as evil as that, of being caught up in just the banality of it and saying, well, that's just kind of the way the world is, and not leaving space for outrage and horror, not leaving space to say it is a terrible thing that 3,000 lives were taken on that day. And so too the golden calf can become something that, if you know the story, can become familiar, can become something that is the end of a Disney animation. You know, it's a scene that you pass through before the next thing happens. And yet, for Israel, for God's people, as they look back, this was to be the formative moment in many ways. For God had brought them out miraculously through plague after plague, had released them from the oppression of Pharaoh. They'd seen the terrible death of the firstborn. They'd walked through the waters as the sea was parted. And as they came to freedom, they knew that they were to be free to worship God. And he told them how he'd brought them on eagle's wings. He'd cared for them. And they were now to be free, not just to do whatever they liked, but free to worship. And yet, how is it that freedom is exercised? They've got the good law, you know, they understand what they're to do. And yet, as soon as they have the freedom, look at verse 1. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, and Moses had gone up to the mountain to be with God, it had been a 40-day period up there, they saw he was so long in coming down, they gathered around Aaron and said, "Come, make us gods who will go before us, as for this fellow who brought us up out of what's happened to him." See, the moment they've got their freedom to worship God and that he saved them, they say instead, well, who is this Moses fellow, and let us worship the gods instead. And let us make gods. You know, there's a step here to idolatry. Moses, the one who was so close to God and who really mediated God's presence, mediated sort of between God and Israel, so that if Israel was to deal with God at all, it was going to be through Moses. Moses was the special one who was in that place, and yet they so quickly turn away from him, the one who proved himself able to stand against Pharaoh, their great oppressor, the one who proved able to lead them through the sea and into freedom, and they don't want it. Instead, make us gods. What do they mean by that? There's two ways you could read it. You could think, well, they've turned into polytheists. That is, they think there's lots of gods around and they want to worship lots of different gods, and that's the move that they're taking. But I think it's more likely that what's being spoken about here is not polytheism, lots of different gods, but instead idolatry. See what they're asking for? Make us this God. What is it that they do? They fashion an idol. And so I think what they're saying is, well, an idol, God who saved us. And it's a bit tricky because it says gods, but Hebrew does that, and the Old Testament refers to gods as Elohim, a kind of plural word, which is speaking of God. I think what's going on here is idolatry, and certainly that's the way that God will condemn what's taking place here. What they do is do what religious people do everywhere. They say that to represent the unknown, unseeable God, we'll craft a thing out of stone and wood. We'll make an idol in the image that we believe God is, and we'll do it with our hands. And the people who worship idols like that don't actually think that the idol itself is divine, but that it represents the divine. That's the logic of idolatry. You can't see the God who created things, and therefore you make something that stands for him. And yet the Ten Commandments, we know that that is not the way to worship the God who brings all things into being. He's the one who fashions us. We're not the one who is to fashion him. He's the one who is unseen. He's going to be revealing himself on his terms through his Saviour Moses, who will lead the people out, through his word, which is powerful, but not through calf. You see calf. You see heaven. The Lord says to Moses, this is on top of the mountain, go down, because your people whom you brought out of Egypt have become corrupt. They've become quick to turn from what I commanded them, and they've made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf. They've bowed down to it. They've sacrificed to it. They've said, these are your gods, Israel, who brought you out of Egypt. I've seen these people, the Lord said to Moses. They are a stiff-necked people. Leave me alone so that my anger may burn against them, that I might destroy them, and I'll make you into a great nation. There's this awful turn there, that the God who loves these people and has brought them out is the God who now says to Moses, they're your people, not my people. They're your people. You brought them up. They've turned away from the commandments. They've gone to idolatry. This is a moment where God is saying the covenant is broken. This seems like the end. All that God says here in terms of a possible intention is to wipe them out. He might push ahead with Moses, but not with these people. These people are stiff-necked. You know, they're not going to change from this. This is a terrible plight that they're in. I don't know if you've ever been stiff-necked, worked too long at a desk. Maybe it's an occupational hazard in the law, I know. And that stiff-necked is, you know, when you're locked in, nothing that can be, you know, hours of massage and electrical therapy and all the right things in the world. But the stiff-necked thing is something that can't be cured, you know. And God says, well, that's his verdict on his people. But in that moment, Moses steps up. And he steps up to intercede for them and to plead for them before God. And it's a plea not for not for justice, but for mercy. It's not one of mitigation or denying that, you know, they're in the wrong, but instead saying the appeal is to God and to his character. So in verse 11 it says, why should your anger burn against your people whom you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say it's with evil intent he brought them out to kill them? See, Moses here appeals to not Israel's character, but to God's, to say, you've shown yourself to Egypt. What's it going to look like if you show yourself now as the one who destroys your people? Appealing to God in that way. Or then appeals to the way he'd made promises to Abraham, to Isaac and Israel, to whom you swore by your own self, I'll make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. So in the book of Genesis, before Exodus, you have God making these promises to Abraham and to his descendants, who become the people of Israel as the family becomes a nation. And God had promised that this family, this nation, would become as numerous as the stars in the sky. Well, the appeal is not to Israel's faithfulness, but to God's faithfulness, to say that promise needs to stay. Now, of course, God could rebuild through Moses. You know, he could go that way instead, but Moses doesn't engage with that, doesn't mention that. Instead, he pulls back to that promise and takes his stand there, pleading like that before God. The language here is so strong that the theologians really grapple with it and say, how do we understand this? The thought of God changing his mind, or of relenting or repenting like that, how do we account for that? And yet the story isn't apologetic. Instead, there is this genuine tussle that seems to be going on, this genuine engagement between Moses and God, where the future of the people are at stake. There is this moment, because this horror of the golden calf really is terrible. We I think, are so quick to excuse it, to explain it away and to say it's a moment's aberration, or it's only a different form of worship or something like that. It's not as though it deserves the wiping out of a whole people. And yet the holiness of God up against the stiff-neckedness of this people, how is it ever going to work? How can you ever have a holy and perfect God giving his good and perfect laws, and people who, the moment they hear it, run away from those laws? And it's not as though we stand here and can say, well, that's obviously a problem for stiff-necked people, it's not a problem for me. No, this is the same problem I see in my heart, that when I hear God's good law that says, do not covet, you know, that's a good thing. We know that life's better if you don't go around coveting. So why is it that as soon as I hear that law, and I hear my mate who's just bought another investment property, and I feel the covetousness kind of well up in my heart, how is it that good law seems to create in me a bad desire? The problem isn't with the good law that says, live this way, this is the good way to live. The problem is with my stiff neck and my hard heart. And how is it that there's to be any hope for me, for Israel, for you, for this world? Stiff-necked people come up against a God who says this is the good way to live, and our natural inclination is to turn against it, is to gather up the gold and to throw it into a fire and cast ourselves an idol that's just easier to arrange. To say, this is the way we choose to worship, or this is the way I like to think of God. That's idolatry. This is the way I would like to live, and I'd like God to baptize that. You know, well, that's a rising up against God. And yet, we see remarkably that God relents. It says it there, and it'll come back to this theme over the next couple of chapters. And I want to leave you to kind of have a look yourself at how that develops. But the Lord relents and doesn't bring on his people the disaster that he'd threatened. It's not that God is soft. There will be judgment that comes, and we see that some of the Levitical priests in the next chapter will be bringing judgment on this people. We'll see that this generation will actually die in the wilderness with time. And it'll be their children that walk into the promised land. But you do see God at work here, relenting of the terrible judgment which he had threatened. He does respond the question that Moses offers to the plea that's taken place. It's a dramatic scene as Moses comes down the mountain and smashes the tablets and grinds the golden calf to powder and has the people drink them. But he also exposes just the way that Aaron is a terrible leader. The people come to him and he just gives them what they want. Instead of standing on what God had said, he follows the lead of the people. And when asked to explain it, he says to Moses, "Well, I threw the gold in the fire and out came this calf." You know, a defense that's not going to stand up. And the consequence is that God is not going to go into the promised land with his people. Instead, he'll meet in a special tent of meeting with Moses, and then later in the tabernacle, another special tent. But there's going to be a separation that marks God and his people, something that will always stand between them, always remind them of their stiff-neckedness, of their hard-heartedness, of the inability of them to come before a holy God, of this terrible dilemma which they're in. I say always. In fact, themes of the Bible is the way that separation between man and God is going to be overcome as Jesus comes. It's symbolically seen in his death, and we're told that at the moment he dies, the curtain of the temple, the thing that separates the people from God, that reminds them of their sin and his holiness, of the way they can't come into his presence, we're told that it's ripped, and it's ripped from top to bottom. This thick curtain that's as thick as your hand, that couldn't be ripped, is ripped by God to show that with the death of this one, a mediator has come between an unholy people and a holy God, and God has done something about it. He's brought a forgiveness that the people could never win for themselves. It's a continuation of this story. It's more of where Exodus is heading. But you see that God works to bring his people to that freedom through terrible suffering, through judgment. The judgment here of the golden calf, the judgment of the cross. God doesn't just make a promise and then deliver you straight into the promised land. You ever wonder why he didn't do that with Abraham? You know, instead, they're brought into slavery. Why did that happen at all? Well, we're not told, but I wonder. You don't get to appreciate freedom until you know that you've been oppressed. You don't really get to enjoy the presence of God in the same way until you know that on your own merits you're shut out from it. You don't get to be who you really meant to be until you've turned away from what that is. It's speculation a bit on my part. But God's verdict on the way people exercise their freedom is to say you're stiff-necked and you need to be brought to a better way. I'm going to stop, give you a chance for questions and comments. Thanks, George. More coming, but let me start with these. I suspect this is Peter Young. I'm learning to read the handwriting. You can nod if it's right, Peter. Is freedom of conscience and to worship the most important freedom in today's world? I'm looking at you, Peter. Oh, he wants to be anonymous. Thank you. Of course, it's not Peter. And neither are the next ones. Is freedom of conscience the most important thing? I think it's helpful to see freedoms connected, and so the freedom we have for free thought, I think, is hard to argue with because it's just something that goes on inside your cranium, right? But that thought naturally leads to speech. So we're right to think, how does speech relate? How is it when you speak with others and you share those thoughts? So there's freedom of association as we meet here. The freedom of worship you might think of narrowly in terms of, you know, a a Sunday gathering or a Bible talk or something like that, but it pushes out to manifestation, to actually say, because of these convictions, I actually want to act in this certain way and to do it in concert with others. And then you've got to ask, well, how do those freedoms relate to the freedom of others? You know, how do those freedoms bounce up against each other? So I think it's helpful to make them in a basket of associated kind of rights and maybe working out from an internal thing to a manifestation. Is it difficult to worship without material things such as a Bible or a Quran or an assembly place of some sort? Yes. The biblical idea is not a Platonic kind of idea where you've got to free yourself of matter and go into a perfect world of the ideals, which is separated in order to be really spiritual. Worship will inevitably involve our bodies, who we are, and the way we eat, the way we live. It's a very earthy kind of thing that takes place. And so the ban on idolatry is not because these things are material, it's because these things are invested with a divine kind of understanding. It's wrong to think of the God who can't be seen in ways that we want to prescribe, and we become the kind of author of who God is and what he's like. If God cannot be seen, then it's wrong to make him visible. The very representation is actually a lie about what God is like. If God is the God who speaks, it's wrong to have a dumb as the one who represents what he is like. You know, they're the problems you get that when you try and capture the living God in the form of an idol, and it's why we the Christian hope is in Jesus, who comes, who knows the Father, and shows us what God truly is like. Did Aaron, there will be a festival to the Lord, think the calf idol he'd made was consistent with worshipping the Lord? Yes, I think that's right. I think that's a helpful bit to point to, that this is not a kind of polytheism where they're chasing after a different God. They're wanting to say the God who we worship, we'll have a festival to him and we'll represent him to an idol. There's a mixing of the things which God has said, worship me this way, with, you know, an idolatry as a way of representing the true God. Yes. Is there a tendency in this culture to be impatient with God and create a God that suits us, even a Jesus? Yeah, it's a very profound question there, I think. Particularly the little word impatient. Notice that there was an impatience for Moses when he'd gone 40 days. I don't know if it's just social media. I can't make it through even a news segment now without wanting to check something on the phone or to have an answer straight away. And the thought of a 40-day wait for something? No. Give it to me now. You want to go and research that? No. Give me the advice, you know. Tell me what the answer is. It must be on Google somewhere. And so the God who speaks and may not have spoken for hundreds of years to his people through a prophet, comes on terms and at a speed that we don't sit easily with sometimes. I think there is, in that moment where we might be called to wait and to be patient, there's a very big temptation to just say, okay, I'm going to make Jesus into that will fit. We make Jesus himself a kind of plastic, moldable kind of figure that will fit with how I want God to be seen. And I like to think of Jesus as ... Once you finish that sentence, then you're really engaging on idolatry. It sounds like without Moses' intervention, God would have abandoned his people. What does that say about God's unfailing commitment and promises? He seems to have had a violent temper and inconsistency of character. I love that question. Yeah, it's without Moses, God would have acted that way, and yet God is the one who calls Moses. So God is also the one who acts through Moses to do this thing, and yet if God is responding to something that Moses does that mean he can be consistent and trust his promises? Well, that's the thing that Moses says. You've got to be consistent, and your promises have to be trustworthy. I don't want to answer that question. I just want to let it sit there a little bit and say this is exactly the kind of thing we need to grapple with to see, can God be trusted? And not to answer that so fast that we fail to take account for the way that God genuinely does engage with this world and with his people. It's the same kind of question that says, well, why should we pray? Why engage with God if God's decided things anyway? And yet, part of the way that God acts providentially, knowing every hair on your head, knowing everything which is in control, is through humans being responsible to the calling he gives them. It is actually a freedom which is set up under God's sovereignty, a freedom, a responsibility as humans that God is serious in his engagement with. That doesn't make him contingent on humans and subject to their stiff-neckedness, but actually able to work through that. How you express that properly, I'd love to be able to write the book that says it. I've got a number of books on my shelf that try and say it, but what I want to do is leave it a little bit unanswered, and so it's a brilliant question, and let's keep wrestling with that. The judgment for sinners seems swifter in the Old Testament than the new present day. Why is that? When you get to Hebrews, you say, and I think 1 Corinthians picks this up as well, 2 Corinthians picks this up as well, this generation that die in the wilderness will stand as a warning for us, because while they saw what happened in the parting of the seas and the death of the firstborn, we are able to see a greater salvation that has taken place at the cross. And so if we ignore that, and if we don't obey, then there is a warning there of a worse judgment to come. The speed of it, it's only God's mercy, Old Testament or New, that it doesn't come in this moment. And that's what the cross speaks to as well. It speaks to God's mercy. So freedom is connected to responsibility. Freedom is not an open-ended kind of thing, that they're just free from Egypt, but they're free to be the people that they were made to be. Yeah, so that therefore there is a responsibility to live out that calling. And that the terrible dilemma is, will they have the resources to do that? How will sin be dealt with? That's a slightly different question, of course, than the civic question facing us all at the moment about how we, with very different beliefs, are able to live together well. So if someone today was to say, well, I'd like to be a golden calf worshipper and make a great golden bull in the middle of Martin Place and bow down before it, how do we respond to that? You know, do we say, we actually give civic space for people to make foolish decisions like that, which we're convinced are wrong, and we'll advocate for what we believe is right, but we also think that the role of the state is not to make those kind of decisions, because people need to stand before God accountable for the way they live. So we want people to be able to bow down to false gods. I think that's the short version of the answer I'd give in terms of freedom and responsibility and the place of the state today. I think some of these double up things we've had. What's the difference, significant difference between a man and God? The difference is we are part of although we're in the image of God, ruling over the creation, we are very much part of creation. And God is above, beyond, before creation. He's the one who brings creation into being from nothing. And that's the problem with idolatry. It builds from within the created order to speak to one who is outside of it. It's another angle on what the problem is. From all the gods of the ancient world, this just wasn't on their horizon at all.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.